Hi, this is Tabletop Bro, and you are listening to Tale of the Manticore.
The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Tale of the Manticore, Season 2. Like the creature from which it takes its name, Tale of the Manticore is a mashup, a crossbreeding between two different species of storytelling. Here, you will find the unpredictability of old-school RPG paper and dice games with the storycraft of a dark fantasy novel. No character is sacred, and no character will be spared if the dice decide their fate is at hand. According to lore, the tail of a manticore is barbed with cruel iron spikes. There will be much pain in the days ahead. Last time, on Tale of the Manticore. The last chapter begins with a pair of level-ups as both of the party's spellcasters increase in power. From there, we cut to a flashback in which Bazu meets a wise Camranthian monk and learns how to find courage through faith. This gives us some insight into how he stood his ground against the Yethound when most of his allies fled. At this point, the narrative returns to the present, picking up where the story left off in the battle with Krell. The Dice Gods choose Shanae to be the monster's target when everyone scatters and it gives chase. But the pursuit doesn't last long. Krell catches up with a young rogue in the nearby salon. When Yellowfly and Bazu burst into the room, Shanae is able to escape in the ensuing melee. Eventually, and in no small part thanks to Catsbane's earlier success in injuring it, the PCs manage to slay the beast. Yellowfly drives the Silverthorn through its heart at the same moment that Bazu throws open the window, disintegrating it with daylight. Chapter 65, Part 1, Day 183, Late Morning. Jace, 45 of 45 hit points. Jace was not a coward. He had never been a coward. But when the monster roared, he had imagined himself eviscerated, just like that hunter he and Otwek had found on their way back from Wilmington when he was just 17 years old. But it had been more than just imagination. Somehow, he had known it would happen with absolute certainty, and so he had fled for his life. He remembered that he had gone up the stairs because they were the closest way out. Beyond that, it was hard to say for sure. There was a long hall that stretched straight ahead, and he had sprinted down its entire length, body pitched forward, with his arms and legs pumping faster than they had ever done before. It was too dark to see much of anything, but he had only cared about getting away. He knew he ran the full length of the hall because at the end of it, he slammed hard into a stone wall. When he recovered, he groped blindly to either side. To his left, the unyielding texture of wood, a closed door. To his right, empty space. He went right. Another hall, or so he thought. He kept his left hand touching the wall as he went. Here was another door, a double door to be precise. It felt cool to the touch. He did not open it, but stumbled forward in utter darkness. The feel of the stone wall against his fingers was a lifeline to reality, and his only way to navigate. He slowed his pace now. The feeling of frantic terror was no less, but his lungs would not allow him to maintain his previous pace. He tasted blood and realized he had split his lip when he hit the wall earlier. His fingers suddenly touched empty air, and now he was untethered from all sense of space. There was a terrible feeling of solipsism for a few moments while he stumbled drunkenly to one side. He was grateful to find purchase once again. It was the outer lip of an archway, and probably a room beyond. There was a very bad smell here, but he stumbled in anyway. A few steps in, he tripped on a mass of something unyielding. Now he was on his knees. Jace waved his hands out in front of him. Nothing there. He put them on the floor and began to feel around. It was covered in things. His right hand grasped a shape that was both jagged and sharp, like a broken tree branch. His left found a lumpy pile of squishy wet rags. He moved his hand a little further, and his fingers sank into something jelly-like. He snatched the hand back. It stank of rot. Jace froze as, all at once, his rational mind returned to him and he realized from where he knew the smell. There was an abattoir a few blocks away from his parents' ironmonger shop. As a kid, he'd always avoided walking by it because it smelled so bad. On shaky legs, he stood up and backed slowly out of the room, with his gorge rising. Earlier, I decided that a Yethhound's fear attack would act like the spell, cause fear, and last a full 20 minutes. I think for the sake of keeping the narrative moving, I'm going to rule that at the moment the monster was slain, the magical fear was dispelled. This means that shortly after Jace reaches his current location, the magic ends and he returns to normal. I wonder what kind of experience Catsbane had during this time. Let's turn the clock back a few minutes now and see what the young mage went through. Chapter 65, Part 2, Day 183, Late Morning, Catsbane, 21 of 21 hit points. Spells available. Catsbane has memorized Magic Missile, Invisibility, Mirror Image, Haste, and Slow. If he hadn't already been halfway up the curving stairs, Catsbane surely would have run down to the tower's first level. There he would have found his old chamber and his old bed and even some of his old possessions. He had been replaced by a new apprentice after the debacle with Lady Bellagret and his subsequent flight, and she had inherited all of Phelan Orla's old books. But since Catsbane had been halfway up the stairs when the beast howled, he had dropped his oil lamp and fled the rest of the way to the tower's third story. Once inside Carrick's private chamber, he had cowered under his old master's writing table with his arms wrapped around his knees and rocking himself like a frightened child. He couldn't say how long he stayed in this position, perhaps a few seconds, perhaps a few minutes. And then, quite suddenly, the mind-erasing terror was gone, and he could think clearly once again. It was a bit like waking from a bad dream. Catsbane crawled out from under the desk and stood up. He looked around, seeing Carrick's room for only the second time in his life. On his last visit here, he had tried to take a book from one of the two bookshelves, and the volume had resisted his pull. That had made him afraid, and he had left. He didn't feel afraid now. After the intensity of the emotions he had just experienced, he didn't feel much of anything. At that moment, the chamber felt calm and still. A light breeze came in through the room's single archtop window. It felt cool on his skin, which he now realized was moist with perspiration. He wiped his brow and continued his survey of the room. As before, it was sparsely decorated and well-ordered, with a few notable exceptions. There were spider webs and dust in the nooks and crannies where the wind could not reach, but these were not the things that attracted Catsbane's notice. On the floor by the far wall was one of Carrick's books. It looked as though it had been flung there, which was most strange. Also on the floor, but over by one of the bookcases, was a jeweled dagger. The green of its enameled handle shone and winked at him from the shadows. Chapter 65, Part 3, Day 183, Late Morning. Party status. Yellowfly, 28 of 39 hit points. Bazu, 21 of 21. Spells available. Bazu has prayed for Cure Light Wounds, times 2, Bless, and Silence, 15-foot radius.
"You're hurt," said Bazu.
He was right. There was blood seeping through the chinks in the sleeve of Yellowfly's scale mail shirt. "It's nothing," grunted the fighter. "Let's find Shone." At first, it seemed as though she were not there, but that would be impossible, for they had seen her run this way, and the room had no exits. It was a 30 by 40 foot rectangle, a third of which was taken up by an enormous canopy bed of white wood. Its mattress and sheets had been shredded and appeared bloodstained. There was also a wardrobe, smashed to tinder, and a side table, similarly destroyed. Rich clothing, fallen paintings, and other various art objects of different materials were strewn about the floor. Yellowfly analyzed the scene. This had probably been Culfrey's bedroom. He had heard that the homes of the wealthy sometimes had secret doors and passages in them. Perhaps this room had something like that. He was about to share this notion with Bazu when Shawnee's blonde head popped up from behind the bed, and her bright eyes locked with his. Slowly, the rest of her emerged, and she stepped out from hiding. Her eyes were sunken, her hair was lank, and her chest was heaving. Before Yellowfly could say another word, she raced across the room and threw herself into his arms. They embraced for a moment before she pulled away.
"I thought it would get me," she breathed.
"Not while there's blood in my veins," replied Yellowfly, meaning every word.
"Nor mine,"
echoed Bazu.
"And Yellowfly, now will you allow me to see to your hurt?"
"All right, Bazu. And then we search this place. If there are any clues to be found about what happened to Culfrey, My guess is they'll be here. At this time, I need to take a break from the narrative and roll the result of Bazu's Cure Light Wounds spell. Yellowfly will get a d6 plus 1 hit points restored. The roll is 4 plus 1 is 5. Yellowfly's current total goes up to 33 of a possible 39. Not bad. As long as I've got a d6 in my hand, I might as well roll to see how the PC's examination of the room goes. There's a couple of things in it that were not hidden and will be found no matter what the roll, but I think there's a decent chance there would also be something secret in Caulfrey's bedroom. That makes sense to me. I'll roll a high-low on the d6. On a 1-3, there's nothing hidden here. On a 4-6, there is. The roll. A 2. Okay, it looks like there are no secret doors or concealed treasures in the room. But what about those items I mentioned earlier? One is a key ring with 3 iron keys. This belonged to Krell, not Caulfrey, and the keys open the City Watchtower's main door, the Captain's office door, and Whitestone Castle's dungeon. The other? Well, perhaps you've already guessed. It's Caulfrey's sword, and it is a very special item because it is magical. Magical in what way? I have no idea. The blade is made from some dark bluish metal that even a smith would have trouble identifying. Beyond that, well, let's find out. At minimum, it is a short sword plus one, but this is the sword of a king, passed down through generations. Might it have other special properties? Another high-low roll with my trusty d6. High means yes, it does. Rolling. A 4. That's great. Looks like I'll need to consult some kind of table to see what it does. The expert rulebook provides the magical sword generator, so I'm going to use that. This generator allows for the creation of intelligent swords, but I am going to omit that part. I don't think a talking sword works for me right now. Here's how my modified generator will work then. Step 1. The sword will have a special purpose if I roll a natural 20. Okay, here goes. 12. No special purpose. Now I skip past all the steps concerning intelligent swords and come to the sword's primary power. D percentile are used here. The roll. 51. Let's see, that's see invisible objects. The rules say this does not include secret doors. Fair enough, but I'm going to say it does detect invisible beings, not just objects. This makes a lot of sense for a king's sword. Who would need something to guard against invisible threats more than a king? The rules say that the holder needs to concentrate to use the power, but I'm overruling that. It works whenever the sword is drawn. Well, I'm really pleased so far, but I feel something is missing. Shouldn't there be a chance that the sword is actually better than plus one? The rules don't seem to cover this. Maybe I just missed that part. Well, as usual, I'll make something up. On a D10, a 1-7 means the sword is indeed a plus 1. On an 8 or a 9, it's plus 2. On a 10, it's plus 3. Here comes the roll. A 5. It's plus 1. But I'm not disappointed in the least. This is a really cool weapon, and I think it deserves a name. In honor of one of my favorite OSR modules, I'm calling this sword the Sentinel, even if Shanae only ever calls it not at all a bad sword. Okay, with that done, I need to figure out how the narrative will proceed. I suspect that since there are no good clues to explain what happened to Caulfrey to be found anywhere in the castle proper, and since there are no more dangers here for the PCs to overcome, that describing how the separated companions come together in narrative would be a tedious thing. Instead, I'll just hand-wave those minutes of wandering and calling out and say that everyone's able to retrace their steps to meet back in the library. As Bazu, Shanae, and Yellowfly pass back through the salon, Bazu notices something he had missed before. Aranessa's counterfeit holy symbol is on Caulfrey's desk. Krell had been using it as a paperweight. After a moment of surprise, he recognizes it for the fraud it is. He knows the story of what it was made for from his companions, and tosses it back on the desk with a wry smile before following Yellowfly out. When the three of them reach the library, Catsbane is already there. He's holding his small lamp, retrieved from where he dropped it on the steps, and relit. Like Shanae, he is also holding a new weapon, Carrick's magical dagger, with its lizard-shaped handle. The reunited quartet compares stories briefly, and Catsbane learns how they killed the beast. Jace is the last to arrive, as he managed to cover a good distance before the magical fear ended. When he walks down the steps and into the lantern light, everyone is concerned to see that his hands are covered in blood, as are his legs, up to the thigh. Jace explains how he accidentally discovered the monster's lair, along with the remains of more victims, or so he believes. Let's take a quick ad break. When we return, we'll pick up the narrative here, as the companions now have a decision to make.
Hey, this is Sid. I am one of the cast members of Resting Glitch Face, as well as the editor and producer. 2081 has been a hell of a year for St. Louis, Missouri. An astral anomaly left a 2-mile radius around downtown, a toxic hellscape, and a massacre at a boxing match left hundreds dead or missing. At the center of it all are the Glitches, a shadow-running team made up of Bianca the Face, aka Eris, Val the Technomancer, aka Binary, Sho the Muscle, aka Collateral, and Jet the Sneak Thief, aka, well, Jet. Some of us are better than others at sticking to a codename. The girls attempt to navigate the criminal elements of the St. Louis streets, all while looking out for themselves, each other, and the people they love.
We should search this place from top to bottom, said Yellowfly. Jace shifted uncomfortably at that. He had no desire to return to where he had just been, or to see what he had put his hands in. It had been bad enough in the dark. So he nodded in vigorous agreement when Bazu countered.
May we not search instead from bottom to top? I understand why we are here, but I must know the fate of Aranes and of all my brothers and sisters. We should go directly to the dungeon, if you've no objection, Yellowfly.
No, I have no objection, Bazu. Though I'd caution you to not let hope cloud your reason. You know what we're likely to find down there.
Granted, Yellowfly, but I need to see it with my own eyes. Eventually, I should like to recover their bodies and return them to the church for a proper burial.
Eventually, agreed Yellowfly. I haven't seen any stairs going down. It might take a while to find the dungeon, I suppose. Shani turned to him with a faraway look in her eyes. No, it won't. I know how to get there. With that, she walked back the way they had come. The others followed her out of the library, through the white and pink rooms, then down the stairs into the great hall, and east until they reached the door by which they had entered the castle. Eventually they came to the dark hallway through the arch that they had not taken when they arrived. Bazu suddenly remembered the furtive whisper that had passed between Yellowfly and Shanae, and now he understood.
Shanae, if you would prefer to wait here...
Don't be stupid, she snapped, with a little too much edge. Hand me that lantern. The cleric gave her the light, and Shanae took the lead, walking past a closed door on their right, while muttering, small mess. The hallway took a 90-degree turn to the right, and then continued another 30 feet. It terminated at a heavy door banded with iron. Shanae tried the handle. It was locked, as she'd expected, but one of the keys they had found in the king's bedchamber clicked loudly when they tried it, and the door opened on rusty hinges. Some part of her wished that none of the keys had worked. It felt wrong trying to break into a place she had so desperately wished to never see again. She squared her shoulders and passed through, holding her light in one hand and her new sword in the other. She entered another hall and looked down its familiar length. The last time she had passed through here, she had been jubilant. The time before that, on her way in, they'd had to drag her by the hair. Now, going back to Caulfrey's prison, she felt a strange sensation, cousin to nostalgia, but there were feelings of dread and anger, too. It was a complicated emotion. There was a door ahead and to the left that she knew belonged to the warden's office, and it was this room, with the exception of her own cell, that she remembered best of all. Dramatis Personae. Shanae. 3 years ago.
This was your third time here,
grunted the warden, marking something in his ledger.
Let's make it your last, eh? No more fighting, and stay out of the merchant's district.
The warden was a balding man of middle years. He had a long, drooping mustache and no beard that Shanae thought made him look ridiculous. Although she knew it was wiser to keep her mouth shut, she had mocked him about it in the past, and this had not endeared her to the man who now looked up at her, sour-faced.
Here are your things.
He picked a box up from the floor and fished out three items that constituted all of Shanae's worldly possessions. They were a copper penny, a loaded die, and a pair of shabby leather shoes. He put them on the table and she snatched them up. Standing behind her was the man-at-arms who had collected her to be released. He cuffed her sharply across the back of the head and barked, Wait on the warden's order, piglet. Shanae had wanted very badly to stamp on the man's foot. Instead, she bit her lip and held her tongue.
Do you swear to Vesaluna and to your king to lead a life of peace and order from now on?
His voice was mechanical. The warden had said these words so many times that they had lost all meaning. He had, in fact, said them to her twice before. She nodded and received another smack to the back of the head.
Speak up, piglet,
Instead of cannoning her elbow backward into the guard's stomach, as was her inclination, she managed a relatively loud, "I do so swear," through gritted teeth.
"Goddess help you,"
sighed the warden, shaking his head slightly from side to side.
"Well, make your mark."
He pushed his ledger over to her along with a piece of charcoal. The guard behind her chuckled when, after a few seconds of inaction, it became apparent that she couldn't read.
"Right here,"
said the warden, sighing again. Shawnee drew an X in the spot indicated. Behind her and over her shoulder came the guard's mocking tone once again.
"Look at that. I didn't know pigs could write."
The warden didn't laugh, but the guard guffawed at his own joke. Shawnee felt her cheeks go hot with humiliation.
"Get her out of here,"
said the warden, irritated.
"And you. It costs the king more money than you're worth to keep you fed. Don't come back, or I'll make sure you find out what's below the common cells."
Shawnee didn't know why she did it. Maybe it was because she was powerless to hurt the guard who had shamed her. He wore steel boots and a heavy chain hauberk. But whatever the reason, she suddenly found herself flinging her copper penny into the warden's face and shouting, "Here's for my rent!" The coin bounced off the man's cheek, and although his brow furrowed in ire, he did not move. Instead, in a very slow and heavy voice, he said,
"Throw her back with the others for another month."
"This is the warden's office," said Shawnee with disdain. "No need to go inside, unless our keys don't work, and we can't find ones that do." Yellowfly gave her a questioning look, so she explained. "The guards keep their keys on a wall hook. They might well still be there if they left this place in a hurry. Let's go." She led them past the warden's office to the top of a stairwell that led down into darkness. There was something very menacing about it, but they proceeded nonetheless, with Shawnee in the lead, holding the lantern. Then Yellowfly and Jace. Bazu and Catsbane took up the rear. Halfway down the stairs, they could feel the temperature begin to drop. It was dank and smelled of death. Every 10 feet, the stair wall was punctuated by a crude iron basket sconce containing an expired torch. The bottom of the stairs opened directly into the prison. It was really just a single wide hall with cells to either side. First, to the left and right, were a pair of private cells with thick doors of oak. Beyond that, Shawnee knew, were the common cells, each one a rectangle of 20 by 40 feet that mirrored each other. These had no doors, but were separated from the thoroughfare by a wall of iron bars. At the far end of the prison were two more private cells, much like the others, but with bars like the common pens, not doors. "As I thought," said Shawnee. She had been the first to reach the prison floor, and thus the first to find the loop of keys hanging from a hook on the wall directly over a crude three-legged stool. She remembered that there would typically be a single guard on duty in the dungeon, and that they would move the stool to keep watch from the far side in the summer months, in order to keep cool. In winter, that end became uncomfortably cold, so they moved the stool to the other side, right by the stairs. There was no guard here now. In fact, the place was still and silent, save for the squeaking of rats. Shawnee set her lantern on the stool, while Jace plucked a torch from the wall. He lit it from the lantern's flame, and Catsbane did the same with another torch and his own small lamp. Soon they could see about halfway across the dungeon. Despite telling herself that she was not bothered to be back, Shawnee found that her heart was in her throat, and she almost choked on her words when, to nobody in particular, she tried to joke, "My home away from home."
"Shawnee, why don't you stay here and guard the stairs?"
This time the young thief gave Bazu a look of gratitude and did not protest. It fell to the other four to search the place, lighting more torches as they went. Their survey did not take long. All of the cells contained corpses. About half had been horribly mutilated. Many of those that still had faces were, despite having been withered by months of terror and starvation, known to Bazu and Catsbane. Had she participated in the search, Shawnee would have recognized all of them from her time in the church's dormitory, for it soon became apparent that the only prisoners that had not been savaged were female. They searched the private cells closest to the stairs last. One of them was empty. The final cell held the body of Aranes. She had died of starvation, it appeared, and in a most peculiar position. The High Priestess was on her back, with her legs straight out and one arm folded across her breast. That hand had the thumb and pinky tucked in, and three fingers showing. The other arm, and this was odder still, was raised straight above her head. The hand had one finger out and the rest curled in. Upon seeing her, everyone immediately had the same thought. She was pointing at something. Thank you for listening to Tale of the Manticore.
If you've enjoyed the show and would like to support it, here are a few ways you can help. You can recommend the show online or to friends. You can like and repost episode announcements on social media. You can pick up One Shot in the Dark, the Pendulum Worldbuilding Tool, or Encyclopedia Manticorica on DriveThruRPG. And finally, you can rate or review the show on your podcatcher of choice. My thanks to everyone for their support of the show. At this time, please allow me to share one of your very kind reviews. This one was left by Jason Seidel on CastBox. Jason writes, "I anxiously await every new episode. Your gameplay, combined with fabulous lore / background, is not only entertaining, but it helps me be a better player and DM. I appreciate the effort you put into the storytelling, sound effects, and all. Keep up the great work." Cheers for that very kind review, Jason. It means a lot to me that you took the time to write that, and I'm thrilled and honored if anything I'm doing here helps you improve your game at home. Let's take a moment now to talk about the great voice talent in this episode. As usual, Andrew Fling voices Bazu, cleric of Sadal. Andrew is joined by newcomer Hext Press in the role of the Warden. Hext Press has a great YouTube channel where he discusses all things RPG. Be sure to check it out. For listeners who'd like to get in touch with me, I'm at Manticore Tale on X, or Tale of the Manticore Podcast on Instagram. And there's always email, taleofthemanticore@gmail.com. I also keep a blog where I post all kinds of show and RPG-related stuff, like art, maps, tables, crafts, and show notes. You can find it at taleofthemanticore.blogspot.com. And before I sign off, there's something else I wanted to mention. The 4-year anniversary of the show is just a few days away. And as I seem to say on every podcast anniversary, I can't believe I've been doing this for so long. It has been, well, it has been an adventure. In the past, I've done a Tale of the Manticore by the Numbers section here. But this time around, I thought I'd take a more casual approach and just talk a bit about some of the highlights of the past year, which was another year of firsts. I was invited to my first ever convention in autumn of 2023, thanks to the Dungeon Minister for throwing such a great party. I was given my own booth, another first, at Comic-Con in Toronto in March of 2024. Between those two events, Tale of the Manticore surpassed the 500,000 downloads mark. That was a real watershed moment for me. What else? I became a featured artist on RPG Match, and I even started to work on a novelization of Season 1 that I'm hoping to release sometime in the not-too-distant future. Although, I'll be honest, it turns out it's more work than I had expected. I've been constantly surprised by the success of the supplements I've put out. The Pendulum Worldbuilding Tool, which is my most recent supplement, has already achieved silver status on DriveThruRPG, whereas Encyclopedia Manticorica and One Shot in the Dark are both one step better in the Electrum status, and One Shot in the Dark is not so far from going gold, which blows my mind. I know that many of you have picked up those supplements specifically as a way to show support for Tale of the Manticore, and I want to say thanks to everyone who has done that. Much, much appreciated. Finally, in my personal life, I took early retirement from my career as a high school English teacher. I might miss the income, but I don't miss the stress. Honestly, I don't know how I had time to get anything done before. Overall, I wanted to say that I feel very grateful to all of you, Tale of the Manticore's listeners and supporters, for allowing me to have and express my creative voice. It's a privilege to be able to make art. You know, Season 2 is not too far from ending at this point. It will likely wrap this summer. It's hard to say exactly since I don't really know what's going to happen next, but it does feel like we're playing through the final module, so to speak. What's going to happen after that? I have some things in the works which are, at this point, half-baked, so I won't talk about those. I have a bunch of cool ideas I hope to make happen, and, well, probably a certain amount of random chaos, too. But I suppose that's not only fitting for this show, but it also leads me to my sign-off. Thank you for another year at the mic, and the story will continue on the next episode of Tale of the Manticore, the story where chaos rolls.
Hey there, this is Chas, the DM of Rollbound, a D&D actual play podcast set in my universe known as Teosia on the continent of Kelmra. Follow a narrative, character-driven story centered around a group of characters known as the Silver Lining in our second campaign, Unfettered Epic. Find joy, laughter, and a little bit of ridiculousness every Monday on YouTube and Spotify. Be sure to check out our Twitter, @RollboundPC, for our Discord server and updates on our own unique TTRPG system, Dreams of Teosia.
No, walk back, come back. You need to see this. This could be the most glorious thing you've seen all day.